Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Brennst du für Technologien, die unsere Zukunft verändern? Dann code, plane, pilotiere, entwickle, erfinde, beschleunige und digitalisiere. Industrien, Städte, Mobilität, kurzum, alles, was unser Leben bewegt. Du willst aktiv das Morgen mitgestalten? Dann komm jetzt in unser Team. Geh einfach auf unser Jobportal siemens.de/karriere. Create a better tomorrow with us.
Leute, es wird unangenehm, denn ich muss euch einfach fragen, habt ihr euch eigentlich schon mal um eure Versicherung gekümmert? Hier ist übrigens Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und ich sage euch, es wird allerhöchste Zeit, Ordnung in euer Versicherungschaos zu bringen und dabei kann euch die App Clark helfen. Da arbeiten ganz viele Expertinnen, die das hauptberuflich machen, man glaubt es kaum. Und mit meinem Code TARA60, alles groß und zusammengeschrieben, könnt ihr euch sogar einen Shopping-Gutschein sichern, 60 Euro, bei zum Beispiel Amazon oder Douglas einlösbar, mit dem Code TARA60.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Moss, and in the early hours of Friday, the 19th of April, these are our main stories. Kenya's defense chief and 9 other military personnel have died in a helicopter crash. The president, William Ruto, announced 3 days of mourning.
Our motherland has lost one of her most valiant generals.
A bid by Palestine to gain full membership of the United Nations has been blocked by the US. And we hear how a growing population means Chinese cities are suffering subsidence, with water extraction the culprit.
This is not just a few local places that are sinking. It's something that's affecting a lot of people. There's a lot of commonalities, and there probably needs to be a national response.
Also in this podcast,
we have a disproportionate burden of intimate partner violence. We also see higher rates of femicide, which is the murder of a woman by her partner or a former partner.
New research reveals high levels of domestic violence in the U.S. state of Louisiana. And why UNESCO's famous World Heritage Sites are at the center of controversy over the treatment of indigenous peoples. Flags are flying at half-mast throughout Kenya, 3 days of mourning having been declared after the head of the armed forces was killed in a helicopter crash. 9 other military figures also died. General Francis Ogala had only been in the post for a year. He was himself a fighter pilot. Kenya's president, William Ruto, expressed his personal sadness at the disaster.
Our motherland has lost one of her most valiant generals. We have also lost gallant officers. The sorrow we all feel about this passing on is shared by all of the people of Kenya.
Only 2 people survived the crash in Elgeyo Marakwet County, some 400 kilometres northwest of the capital, Nairobi. An investigation's been launched with details of the crash still coming in. But our deputy Africa editor, Anne Soy, in Nairobi, told Valerie Sanderson what's known so far.
We understand that the general and the other military officers who perished alongside him were on a military mission in the area. It's the northwest of the country, a place that has been plagued by insecurity because of cattle rustling and banditry. And they had been surveying the area and also going to schools that the military is helping to renovate after they were attacked by the suspected bandits. And when the helicopter was taking off from one of the schools, we understand that it came down and burst into flames, killing, now it has been confirmed, 10 people, who include the general, and there were 2 survivors who are now in hospital.
And what can you tell us about General Francis Ogala?
Well, he has had a long career in the military, 39 years, and he was appointed barely a year ago, last April, by President Ruto to that role. And the president has spoken this evening confirming that crash and saying that he's deeply saddened personally and calling it a tragic loss for the military and for the country. Their flags will fly at half-mast for 3 days in honour of the fallen general.
And we understand that there are survivors who may be able to tell everyone more about what exactly happened.
We understand there were survivors. They have been evacuated. The president confirmed that they are now in hospital. He called this crash an accident, but said that the Air Force, the formation from which the general came from, he will conduct investigations to ascertain the cause of the crash. We understand that a unit has already been deployed to the scene of the crash, which has been cordoned off to carry out the investigation.
And what's been reaction in Kenya to this?
There were rumours circulating throughout the day. This is a very remote area in the country. And while it had not been confirmed, there were fears that the general, the senior most military officer, was on board that ill-fated plane. And so it has been confirmed this evening. And people are in shock, really, wondering how this could have happened, especially when you have the senior most military general, as well as other senior officers of the military as well. So many questions will be asked. People will be waiting for the outcome of that investigation.
Our Deputy Africa Editor, Anne Soy, in Nairobi. The result was never really in doubt. The Palestinian delegation made a bid to gain full membership of the United Nations, and the United States vetoed it. Palestine has had observer status since 2012, but isn't able to vote in proceedings. And that restriction will now remain, as announced by the current president of the UN Security Council, Vanessa Frazier.
The result of the vote is as follows. 12 votes in favour, 1 vote against, 2 abstentions. The draft resolution has not been adopted owing to the negative vote of a permanent member of the Council.
So the US had its way with that veto. But in fact, it was hoping to avoid the entire process, as our North America correspondent John Sudworth explained.
There's been clearly heavy lobbying behind the scenes from the US that did not want this to come to a vote. It did not want to be forced to use its veto, but it had signalled in advance that were that vote to be brought, it would have no choice but to vote against. This was almost never going to get across the line today. The United States position is that while it supports steps towards a two-state solution, it felt that granting Palestine full state membership here at the United Nations would be premature, that that move should be predicated on negotiations and a bilateral agreement between the Palestinians and the Israelis. It felt it would be unhelpful. You know, the arguments were rehearsed during the discussions today. We heard from the Palestinian representative saying that although there was recognition that this in itself wouldn't change the facts on the ground, it would bring hope to Palestinian people. But we also heard from the Israeli ambassador saying that 6 months on after the Hamas attacks, this would simply be a reward for terror. It's symbolic, I think, because a lot of people, even knowing that this was going to fail, still seemed intent to bring it to a vote.
John Sudworth in New York. As that debate on the vote was being held, Thursday saw Israel drop dozens more bombs on Gaza. This just a day after a barrage of strikes hit the centre of the Strip, as well as sites in the north. The Hamas-run health ministry says nearly 34,000 people have been killed since the conflict began. That includes at least 70 in the last 24 hours. The attacks by Hamas on October 7th and Israel's response have sparked global street protests. And the fallout now appears to be spreading to the corporate sector. On Thursday, Google confirmed that 28 of its staff have been sacked after they demonstrated against a contract which the tech giant has with the Israeli government. Our business correspondent, Jonathan Joseph, shared more details with Valerie Sanderson.
This is a $1.2 billion contract that the Israeli government has jointly with Google and Amazon, and it's to provide a range of cloud and artificial intelligence computing services to the Israeli government right across the administration. Israel's a country where it's notoriously difficult to get any paperwork done if you're a citizen. So in the healthcare and the education sectors, those are sort of places where it could be used. But the protesters here are concerned that it's being used in the military sphere as well, and in particular to target Palestinians in Gaza.
And Google has sacked them. What did they say?
So Google have said that the protesters' behaviour was completely unacceptable, that these protesters in their New York and Sunnyvale, California offices were disrupting other colleagues, stopping them from being able to do their work, and that this couldn't happen. And in a statement, they said that the contract is not directed at highly sensitive, classified or military workloads relevant to weapons or intelligence services. So they're trying to keep their distance from this idea that there are military applications of this technology. It's also worth pointing out what Google said to some of their own staffers in a memo to them. They said that this is a place of business where every Googler is expected to read our policies and apply them about how they conduct themselves and communicate in our workplace. And the overwhelming majority of employees do the right thing. And they said that if you're one of the few who are tempted to think we're going to overlook conduct that violates our policies, think again. So they're pretty clear that this was not acceptable within the contract that these staffers had.
And what about these 28 people? Are they going to take it further?
These have been long-running concerns amongst Google staff. This isn't the first time they've protested like this. But now these 28 people have lost their job. They have said in a post on social media that they intend to continue making the case against Google having this contract with the Israeli government. So there is the likelihood that this isn't the last we've heard of it.
Jonathan Josephs. It represents an extraordinary movement of people. Half a century ago, China was a predominantly rural country. But since then, the number of people living in cities has multiplied six times. There are now 900 million of these urban dwellers. And that, perhaps not surprisingly, is having a major impact on the physical environment. A new satellite assessment suggests that half the land under major cities is undergoing subsidence caused by human activity. Robert Nichols is a professor of climate adaptation at the University of East Anglia in England. He says one of the main problems is all the water that's been extracted.
When there's a lot of people living on deltas, areas that have been sedimented fairly recently, geologically speaking, and so when you take out groundwater or you drain the soils or whatever, they tend to subside. This is not just a few local places that are sinking. It's something that's affecting a lot of people. There's a lot of commonalities, and there probably needs to be a national response.
Robert Nichols. More on this now from our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath.
According to the researchers here, the geology of China, the weight of the buildings, all those make a contributing factor. But the big issue for them is the extraction and use of water in local city areas. And that is effectively helping these cities sink, at some of them at quite a rapid pace. The scientists say that in some respects it can be quite dangerous, because if different parts of cities are expanding or sinking at different rates, then you can get buildings toppling over and falling down. They point to the example of Beijing, where you've got, because of the development of the metro in some parts of the city, subsidence is going at 45 millimetres a year. In other parts, it's not going so quickly because they're not using so much water. There's been a ban on some of the water use there. So different cities have different speeds of subsidence, and it's that change in speed that makes the likelihood that buildings could collapse in different parts of it. There's a great deal of concern about this, and China has long been aware of this problem. In Shanghai, has sank by 3 metres over the last 100 years, so they're well aware of the issue. They may look at to other countries like Japan, where Tokyo and Osaka, those cities were both sinking in the past, but measures were put in place in the 1970s, essentially to stop people using local water and to bring water from other regions by pipe. Chinese authorities may well be looking at those kind of measures to see if they can put a stop to this very rapid sinking.
Matt McGrath. Every year, tens of thousands of tourists visit UNESCO's famous World Heritage Sites, many of them treasured natural wildlife sanctuaries. But has this prestigious status come at a cost to the people who live there? The campaign group Survival International has accused the UN cultural organisation of complicity in the forcible eviction and abuse of indigenous communities. In a report to mark World Heritage Day, it says that serious abuses are being committed in the name of conservation at several sites in Africa and elsewhere. Our Africa regional editor Richard Hamilton reports.
Survival International says it has uncovered cases of rape, torture and killings of indigenous people in World Heritage Sites in Africa and Asia. These include the Ngorongoro Conservation Area in Tanzania, the Kahuzi-Biega National Park in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Ojala-Kukwa National Park in neighbouring Republic of Congo. The report says what are often called natural world heritage sites are very often stolen ancestral lands where indigenous owners are kept out by force, intimidation and terror. It accuses the UN body of either turning a blind eye to abuses or actively encouraging evictions. Fiore Longo is Survival International's campaign manager.
It's not possible in the world of today that we call World Heritage sites, so something that belongs to the world, to the humanity. We call in this way places where the best guardians of the natural world are being killed, abused and raped. And when I say this, it's really concrete. It's not something generic. The Maasai are losing their cows. They are being shot. Indigenous Patua in Kausi Biega are being raped and their houses are being burnt and their children are being killed. So when we talk about places that are important to us as humanity, we cannot tolerate that in these places human rights atrocities are happening.
Fiore Longo also says it's ironic that the indigenous people are not allowed back onto their land to bury their dead or perform ancient rituals, and yet every year thousands of tourists are allowed into them. While the UN organisation designates World Heritage Sites, the on-the-ground activities in these areas are the responsibility of the authorities in the relevant countries. UNESCO has issued a statement to the BBC strongly contesting the allegations in the report. It says it has made respect for the rights of indigenous peoples a fundamental principle in the management of World Heritage Sites. UNESCO goes on to say that there are more than 1,000 such protected areas, and yet the campaign group has collected testimonies from just 6, hence casting shame on all of them.
Richard Hamilton. It's known in the US as intimate partner violence, the physical abuse which goes on in people's homes. And the state of Louisiana has now assessed the scale of the problem and its economic cost. It found women were 3 times more likely to be the victims, and that in 2022 alone it led to $10 billion being spent on medical bills, the criminal justice system, as well as lost productivity. Anita Raj is co-author of the report, a professor of public health at Tulane University. She told Victoria Uwanhunda the results were certainly not what they'd expected.
We were staggered by the findings. It seems to be higher here than we're seeing in other states. About half of all women have experienced intimate partner violence, and about 200,000 women have experienced it in the past year. We did a costing analysis where we considered the healthcare cost, the cost of the criminal justice system, the costs of labor lost. Overall, the costs to our state are $10.1 billion, which is about 3.5% of our GDP. So it's a staggering amount that it's costing our state.
You mentioned that the figures that you found were higher in the Louisiana state than any other state. How much higher?
We actually only have 2 states that we can do the comparison with at this time. The state that we compare it to is California. It's about 20 to 30% higher here. And we also could see from the crime data, which allows us to look at data across all states, that 22% of violent criminal offenders in our prison system are in there because of intimate partner violence, whereas for the country as a whole, it's 17%. So we know we have a disproportionate burden of not just violent crimes, but intimate partner violence. We also see higher rates of femicide, which is the murder of a woman by her partner or a former partner.
How do you want the state of Louisiana to tackle this issue?
The cost of inaction is clearly high here. So we have to wonder what could be done if you invested in violence prevention programs, domestic violence services. This is really important for everywhere. And many governments simply don't invest in violence prevention, which over time would defray the heavy cost and mental health and physical health toll it's taking on women, families, children in particular are affected as well.
What do you think the issue of intimate partner violence isn't really looked into
I think there's a couple of things. So Louisiana is like a low-income state within the context of the United States. In a lot of low and middle-income environments, we know that there are enormous stressors, but there are also very traditional norms that are maintained. That includes sort of an acceptability that partner violence is something that happens in households. It's their business. It's not viewed in the same light as other forms of violence in terms of it being a crime. In Louisiana, we know that even when people come forward with domestic violence complaints to the criminal justice system, oftentimes that doesn't result in a conviction, and it could even increase a person's risk for more violence at home. And that's not unique to Louisiana. We see that in every country. And again, people have kind of viewed it as something that's just normal and it happens, and it's not our business. It's their personal business.
Professor Anita Raj from Tulane University, speaking to Victoria Wanhunda. Still to come on the Global News Podcast.
It's just a pleasure to be able to work on a cathedral nowadays, like they did almost 1,000 years ago. You got a sensation of the energy that's been given to this building. So it's very hard to leave this site.
We meet the Argentinian carpenter helping to restore Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. Returning now to the Middle East, the US and Britain have announced new sanctions on Iran. This, of course, in response to last weekend's drone and missile attack on Israel. More individuals, companies and military organizations have been added to an existing list of Iranians. They face travel bans and asset freezes. The conflict was top of the agenda at a meeting of foreign ministers from the G7 group of leading economies, as well as the war in Ukraine. That meeting was held on the Italian island of Capri, from where our correspondent Jessica Parker reports.
Plans for fresh sanctions against Iran had been heavily advertised in advance. As G7 foreign ministers met, the UK and the US announced they'd be targeting people and organisations linked to Iran's drone and missile programme. The EU's also promised further restrictive measures. These moves follow Tehran's unprecedented attack on Israel, itself a response to a strike on an Iranian consulate in Syria. Britain's Foreign Secretary Lord Cameron spoke from the G7 meeting on the island of Capri.
Iran's behaviour is unacceptable, and it's right that countries come together here at the G7 and make those points, not just because of what Iran has been doing, but also as a message to Israel that we want to play our part in having a coordinated strategy that deals with Iran's aggression that we saw so clearly against Israel over the weekend.
The other central issue being discussed here is support for Ukraine. One idea is whether interest accrued on frozen Russian assets could be used to help finance Kyiv. Ukraine's pleas for further air defence systems are being loudly echoed. What's less clear is when and how they'll be answered. The Secretary General of the NATO Military Alliance, Jens Stoltenberg, who's here in Capri, said conversations with partners were ongoing, while warning that Russia was pushing along the whole front line alongside waves of airstrikes.
Jessica Parker. They're still just beginning the process of clearing up the mess and destruction left by flooding in the United Arab Emirates. The immediate cause was clear, the heaviest rainfall to hit the Gulf region since records began. As we reported in an earlier Global News podcast, many thousands of passengers have been left stranded at Dubai's main airport, while in neighbouring Oman, 20 people have been killed by the floodwaters. And there are also reports that Yemen has suffered severe damage to infrastructure and property. Flooding's also devastated parts of Afghanistan and Pakistan, as our correspondent in Islamabad, Caroline Davis, describes.
Churning, muddy waters surging through Farah province in western Afghanistan. Heavy rains have battered the country. At least 70 people have been killed, thousands of homes damaged, and farmland deluged. And this is the sound of flash flooding in Pakistan's mountains in the north. Some main roads here are already blocked, with mudslides, heavy rocks and debris falling down steep slopes. Villages are cut off. In the south, Balochistan's coastal cities have also seen flooding. There have been deaths here too. In KP province, one family lost four members, including a nine-month-old baby, when their roof collapsed under the weight of the water. According to Pakistan's official figures, 28 people among the 76 dead were struck by lightning. Both countries have seen a dry few months, followed quickly by heavy rain. Rainfall is not unusual at this time of year, but it's the level and variability that worries climate scientists. A spokesperson from Pakistan's meteorological department said that it had been 99% higher than average across the country. The worst of the weather is not over. There are warnings of landslides, flash flooding and glacial lake outbursts in the coming days.
Caroline Davies in Islamabad. Now to a story rather close to home. The head of the BBC World Service has announced she'll step down from the role in July. And she's not exactly going quietly. In an email to staff, Lillian Landor made explicitly clear she's deeply concerned about further cuts facing the service. Our media correspondent David Sillitoe reports.
It was less than 3 years ago that Lillian Landor returned to the BBC from Channel 4 to take over the running of the World Service. Within 12 months, she had to announce 382 jobs were going, and the Arabic and Persian radio services were to be closed down. In the past, it was the British government, the Foreign Office, that paid for the World Service. But over the last 10 years, that cost has been largely passed on to the BBC. Around three-quarters of the $470 million budget now comes out of the licence fee. And with the BBC's real income dropping by around a third over those years, the World Service has come under pressure. In a statement, Lillian Landor says she's deeply concerned about the operational capacity of the World Service if additional cuts continue to weaken it further. It was only 3 weeks ago that the BBC's Director General, Tim Davie, said an extra $250 million of savings were needed. The British government says it has made an extra $25 million payment towards the World Service Language Services and has begun a review of the way the BBC overall will be funded in the future.
David Sillitoe. It's 4 months since beach walkers in Sydney and elsewhere in Australia began noticing a rather unusual cargo washing ashore, bricks containing cocaine. It seemed clear to police this was some kind of smuggling operation gone awry. And now the mystery could be over. Detectives there have arrested a man, a key member, they claim, of a trafficking network. With more details, here's Sean Wales.
This 36-year-old man from Brisbane has been arrested, believed to be the leader of a crime group with international links. It's alleged the group has brought 2 tonnes of cocaine into Australia in the past year. That's a street value of around $400 million. But one attempt in November to import 900 kilograms of cocaine by sea failed spectacularly for the criminal organisation. Police say the group wasn't able to collect the drugs off the Queensland coast, and police have since been searching for the drugs but couldn't find them anywhere. But then they started appearing all of a sudden. Since December, bricks of cocaine have been washing up on beaches along the New South Wales coast from Newcastle down to Sydney. 256 kilograms have so far been found. Take a listen to Detective Superintendent Adrian Telfer from the Australian Federal Police.
As soon as we suspended our search, we notified authorities in New South Wales that the cocaine could wash ashore down there, and approximately 6 weeks later, that's exactly what we saw. So at this stage, 256 kilograms has been recovered across New South Wales. Obviously, doing the maths, we believe there is more out there.
Yes, another 600 kilograms remains unaccounted for. As for the accused ringleader, he's facing 19 charges and a maximum sentence of life in prison. Australia is among the world's biggest drug users, and especially when it comes to cocaine. The latest figures from the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development shows that more than 4% of Australians aged 15 to 64 had recently used cocaine. That's about 1 million people and well above the second highest country, the United Kingdom. Cocaine is extremely expensive in Australia, so it's a lucrative business, and clearly it's keeping authorities very, very busy.
Sean Wales. It was a moment the residents of Paris are unlikely ever to forget. 5 years ago this week, they looked up to see that one of the city's, indeed one of the country's most famous landmarks, Notre Dame Cathedral, was on fire. Well, there was more bad news for the cathedral's fans last month when it was announced that, contrary to hopes, it would not reopen in time for the Paris Olympics this summer. However, the scaffolding has been coming off the cathedral's distinctive spire, so that at least should be visible. The cathedral itself is now due to open in December, following restoration work that involved around 250 different companies, and hundreds of skilled craftsmen and designers. Among them is Damien Pinardi, a UK-based carpenter originally from Argentina. This is highly specialised work, as we learned when he told my colleague Evan Davis about his particular role.
I shape the trees into usable beams by axe. And my main job was basically for 5 months, hew as much as we could. And we had a kind of a deadline to give our pieces to the next stage. Then I was lucky enough to participate also in joinery as well to do a full raising. And then I was sent to Paris. So basically I did above everything, which is quite amazing.
But hang on, what's your background? You came from Argentina, you're based in Scotland, and you've ended up in helping out on Notre Dame. I can't work out the path that gets you there.
Now I'm always trying to learn new and different things, and learning French carpentry was one of my goals and dreams. Got so much to learn still, and to participate on this project since the day one, basically. I was really, really shocked when that happened. I'm part of the Carpenters Fellowship, which is an organization of timber framing. So there was a chance for us to collaborate with the French carpenters, and I was chosen among some other members of the CF, the Carpenters Fellowship, to be here on this project. But right, originally, now, I'm a cabinet maker.
Tell us about the actual site in Paris at Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. Are people all falling over each other as they kind of work to restore the cathedral?
The mood on the site is amazing. Every single trade are involved at the same time. You know, you're next to a restorer of gold leaves, a blacksmith, the masons. So it's a massive community. I mean, this week I think we're about 600 people on site. But it doesn't feel crowded because it's quite a big site, even though the space around it is not that big. So we have to organize ourselves very, very well. The vibe and the mood and the energy that you take for everyone involved is fantastic. It's probably the best part of this adventure, the people you work with.
After the fire, there were lots of people thinking about what to do with Notre Dame, and there were some quite flashy ideas about how you might make a contemporary cathedral out of the fire-damaged original. I think they haven't really gone for any of that, have they? It's pretty much, let's just restore it, right?
No, it's been completely restored as it was just before the fire. For us, it's just a pleasure, to be able to work on a cathedral nowadays, like they did almost 1,000 years ago. You know, you got a sensation of peace and all the energy that's been given to this building. So it's very hard to leave this site. It's just amazing. You want to see every single step of the way, how the sculptures restore, how the roof keeps growing. But soon my time will be over. It's been more than a year and a half that I'm involved, and probably in a few weeks or a month I should be finished.
I don't know if you saw the tragic fire in Copenhagen this week. They
yes.
compared it to Notre Dame, the Copenhagen Stock Exchange. There's going to be a similar task on that.
Presumably. We got a Danish colleague that was working on the project for quite a long time, so we're going to ask him to get us involved.
Damien Pinardi on the restoration of Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Pete Wise. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. And I'm Paul Moss. Until next time, goodbye.
Was ist noch besser als ein guter Plan? Die Möglichkeit, ihn zu ändern. Mit integrierter KI bietet Workday kontinuierliche Innovationen, die Ihnen helfen, agil zu bleiben, egal was passiert. Workday, the finance and HR system for a changing world.
Brennst du für Technologien, die unsere Zukunft verändern? Dann code, plane, pilotiere, entwickle, erfinde, beschleunige. Und digitalisiere. Industrien, Städte, Mobilität. Kurzum, alles, was unser Leben bewegt. Du willst aktiv das Morgen mitgestalten? Dann komm jetzt in unser Team. Geh einfach auf unser Jobportal. Siemens.de/Karriere. Create a better tomorrow with us.